Welcome to the deep dive. It's kind of wild when you sit back and really think about it. Buying a home is, for like the vast majority of people listening right now, it is the single largest financial transaction of your entire life.
Oh, absolutely. By a mile.
Right. And yet, if you look at the behavioral data, you probably spend way more time reading like Amazon reviews or comparing refresh rates and watching YouTube unboxing videos for a new $1,000 TV than you do physically vetting comparable homes.
Yeah.
I mean, before you drop $500,000 on a 30-year mortgage, you're doing less research than for a flat screen.
It is completely counterintuitive. I mean,
Yeah.
we obsess over those micro purchases because they feel, immediate and
Yeah,
tangible.
you can hold it in your hand.
Exactly. But when it comes to massive, life-altering leverage, emotion just suddenly takes the wheel. We let a beautiful kitchen island completely override basic financial logic.
And that is exactly our mission today. We are going to arm you with a super specific, totally battle-tested framework for buying real estate without an ounce of regret. We are pulling this from a highly comprehensive 2026 guide by a 30-year North Carolina real estate veteran. Her name is Teresa Overcash, and it's called The 333 Rule Real Estate NC Buyers Need Before Making an Offer.
Which is a great title, honestly.
It is. And while she specifically targets the North Carolina market, so places like the Triad and the High Country, and the behavioral truths we're going to unpack today are absolutely universal, no matter where you live.
Right, because the physics of real estate, like the property taxes, the local appreciation rates, those might change from state to state.
Sure.
But human psychology really doesn't. We basically all fall into the exact same cognitive traps when we see a house we love.
What amazed me about the source material is just the sheer specificity of it. Because if you go online looking for real estate advice, you usually get flooded with these vague fortune cookie
Oh,
platitudes.
yeah. Like, buy what you can afford.
Sex, or location, location, location. But this guide gives you a rigid mathematical framework. And I promise you, by the end of this deep dive, you are going to know exactly how to avoid overpaying by thousands of dollars through one simple, completely non-negotiable behavioral test.
And what's fascinating here is that the most interesting part of this guide isn't actually the math. I mean, the
Real.
math is a foundation, sure, but it's really about the psychology of home buying. It's about building systems that protect you from the wild swings of the housing market, and honestly, more importantly, systems that protect you from yourself.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we get to that core behavioral test, the one that literally physically stops you from overpaying, we have to establish the financial foundation.
Correct.
You can't protect yourself from the market if you haven't protected yourself from life's curveballs. So let's dive into the first two threes of the 333 rule. This is your financial defense system. What is the first test?
So test number one is your living expense reserve. You need to have 3 months of your total household living expenses saved in cash.
Okay.
And to be crystal clear here, this money must be entirely separate from your down payment or your closing costs.
Wait, so I can't just look at my bank account, see my massive down payment sitting there, and say, well, if things get tight after I move in, I'll just use a little bit of that.
No. Absolutely not, because that down payment is spoken for. This 3 month reserve, it's the shock absorber for life. Because life doesn't just pause because you bought a house. You could face a sudden job disruption, an unexpected medical bill.
Or, I mean, the classic, the HVAC system in your newly purchased home decides to die in month two.
Exactly. It always happens. And this living reserve is what keeps you from being forced to sell your new home in a total panic
Yeah.
or, putting basic necessities on a 25% interest credit card.
The guide actually gives some really grounding examples based on 2026 median incomes to show what this looks like in practice. For instance, if you are a single earner in Winston-Salem making about $65,000 a year,
Okay.
your monthly outflow is probably around $3,600. So your 3 month reserve target is $10,800. You park that in a high yield savings account and you just pretend it doesn't exist. It is strictly for emergencies.
Because it buys you time. And time is the single most valuable asset when you're facing a crisis, which honestly brings us directly to test number two.
Right, the second three.
Right. So in addition to your living expenses, you also need a separate reserve equal to 3 months of your new mortgage payments.
And just to clarify the jargon here, we are talking about the full PITI, right? Principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. Not just the principal and interest the bank advertises on a billboard.
That is a crucial distinction.
Yeah.
Yes. It has to be the full PITI. And this is particularly relevant right now because property taxes and insurance premiums in North Carolina have just been climbing steadily.
Yeah, the guide notes that as of August 2026, the NerdWallet average interest rate is sitting at 6.50%.
Which is significant.
Right. And the statewide insurance average from Boring Rate is $1,845 a year. So when you calculate that three-month PITI reserve, it is going to be a significantly larger number than a basic online mortgage calculator might lead you to believe.
Oh, absolutely.
And there are some wild local nuances in the source material regarding those taxes, too. Like, let's say you are looking to buy a cabin in Watauga County up in the mountains.
Beautiful area.
It is. And they actually have a remarkably low effective property tax rate, just 0.43%. Yeah. That keeps the PITI in a place like Boone relatively manageable despite the higher purchase prices for mountain homes. But if you drive a few hours east to Guilford County at 0.92% or Forsyth at 0.90%, your tax exposure literally more than doubles.
It's a huge jump.
It is. And that directly inflates how much cash you need to lock away in that three-month reserve.
It really emphasizes why you have to run the numbers on the specific exact address of the home you want, not just some generic citywide estimate.
Right.
Now, it is worth noting that conforming loans, so those are your standard government-backed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgages that, you know, most buyers use.
Right.
They don't strictly require you to prove you have this three-month PITI reserve on hand to close.
Okay, but the guide says jumbo loans do require it, right?
Yes, exactly. Jumbo loans, which just means you are borrowing more money than the standard federal loan limits allow, along with second home loans and investor loans, they absolutely require this reserve.
So they actually check your bank statements for it?
Oh, thoroughly. The lenders for those massive loans read this reserve as a signal of true financial strength. If you can't document 3 months of payments in the bank before you buy, they view you as one minor financial surprise away from defaulting.
Okay, I love the logic here, but I have a major question.
True.
Having these two separate reserves is basically like having a seatbelt for your life and airbags for your mortgage.
I like that analogy.
Thanks. But why do they have to be in separate accounts? I mean, I have a spreadsheet. I can do the math. Why can't I just put like $20,000 into one big savings account and just mentally divide it?
Because doing the math in your head or on a personal spreadsheet is exactly how people unknowingly walk into disaster.
Really?
Yeah. The issue here is the psychological barrier. If both of these reserves live in one giant pooled savings account, human nature just kicks in. You look at that single large balance on your phone app, and your brain tricks you into feeling incredibly wealthy.
Oh, so you let your guard down.
Precisely. Let's say your car breaks down, and it's a major transmission repair. You look at your giant account, you feel totally comfortable, and you just pay for it.
Right.
But because the money was pooled together, you didn't realize that by fixing the car, you just secretly cannibalized your mortgage safety net. You dipped into the airbag to fix the seatbelt.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that makes total sense.
By forcing yourself to keep them in distinctly separate accounts, you maintain a concrete buffer against life and a separate, untouchable buffer against housing loss. One single pool of money simply cannot effectively cover two vastly different categories of risk.
You're building a psychological firewall between a present emergency and your future housing security.
I love that. Okay, so we've got the financial safety nets in place. We are mathematically protected from life. But a financial wall doesn't help if we leave the front door open. How do we stop our own brains from sabotaging the purchase?
Well, this is where the true danger lies for the modern buyer, and it brings us to the core focus of our deep dive today. Test number three, the behavioral check. The rule is brilliantly simple, yet people skip it all the time. You must walk at least three comparable homes in person before making an offer on any of them.
And the phrase in person carries literally all the weight in that rule.
Heavy, heavy emphasis on that. The guide is absolutely ruthless about this point. Zillow photos do not count.
Yep.
Redfin listings do not count. Those fancy 3D virtual tours where you click around the room, they do not count.
They definitely don't.
Even driving by in your car, looking at the mailbox and seeing the roof from the street, that does not count.
The digital age has given us this false, really dangerous sense of intimacy with real estate. We look at a gallery of 40 high dynamic range photos taken with a wide angle lens.
Oh, the wide angle lenses are the worst.
They distort everything. And maybe we watch a highly edited drone video with upbeat music and we feel like we fundamentally know the house. But we don't. We know the marketing department's idealized version of the house.
It's essentially relying on photos for online dating. People use incredibly flattering angles. They bring in professional lighting. They use color filters to make the grass look greener. They do all of this for houses just like they do on dating apps. You wouldn't propose marriage to someone based solely on their profile picture without ever meeting them for coffee to see if you actually get along.
No, you'd be crazy to do that.
Right. So why in the world would you sign a contract for $400,000 on a house without seeing its real-world flaws in person?
That is a phenomenal analogy, and the source details exactly the cognitive mechanism that makes skipping this step so financially lethal. It comes down to a well-documented psychological bias known as the anchoring effect.
Wait, I've heard of the anchoring effect in retail, like when an electronics store puts a massive $2,000 TV right at the front entrance.
Right.
So when you walk deeper into the store and see a $700 TV, you immediately think the $700 one is a bargain, even if it's technically overpriced. How does that weaponize a buyer's emotions in a house hunt?
It works the exact same way with real estate, but instead of anchoring to a price tag, you anchor to an emotional ideal.
Okay, walk me through that.
When a buyer refuses to walk three comparable homes in person, they inevitably anchor their expectations, their emotions, and their entire concept of value to the very first home they tour. They walk in, they imagine their furniture in the living room, they fall in love.
And they stop thinking rationally.
Completely. And when you are emotionally anchored like that, you start defending a purchase price that the actual market data does not defend. You convince yourself it's worth the asking price because you have no physical, tactile frame of reference to challenge that belief.
And the financial cost of that emotional anchoring is just staggering. The guide shares this stark statistic. Skipping this three comparable physical walkthrough usually results in a buyer overpaying by 3 to 8%.
Which is massive.
It is. Let's break down the math on that for a second. If you are buying a fairly standard $300,000 home in the Triad market, a 3 to 8% overpayment is a $9,000 to $24,000 mistake.
Ouch.
Yeah, that is cold, hard cash vanishing into thin air, and you don't just magically get that equity back the next year.
No, it takes years of market appreciation to dig yourself out of a $24,000 hole. And the guide makes a really critical point here. Cash buyers are uniquely vulnerable to this specific mistake.
Wait, really? You'd think cash buyers hold all the cards. Why are they more vulnerable?
Because they don't have a lender acting as a safety net.
Oh, I see.
Right. When you get a mortgage, the bank mandates an independent appraisal to guarantee they aren't lending you more money than the house is actually worth. That appraisal is a built-in structural defense against gross overpayment. A cash buyer doesn't have that institutional backstop.
So if they mess up, it's all on them.
Exactly. If a cash buyer anchors emotionally to a property and decides to overpay by 20 grand, there is no bank underwriter stepping in to pull the emergency brake. Nobody's going to stop them from making a terrible deal.
Wow, I hadn't thought of that. But when you follow the rule, when you actually walk three comps, you completely flip the script. You get the power of context. You show up to the negotiation table with defensible reference points.
Yes.
The guide uses this fantastic script example. You can say to the seller's agent, look, your client's home is priced $30,000 higher than the ranch down the street in Clemens. I know this for a fact because I stood in both of them yesterday. The other house already has an updated kitchen and a perfectly flat yard, while yours is entirely on a slope.
You're hard to argue with that.
Right.
Yeah.
That context turns what the seller might view as an insulting lowball offer into a highly logical, unassailable negotiation stance.
What's fascinating here is that the physical walkthrough exposes the sensory condition issues that high-definition photography is specifically designed to hide.
Like what?
Well, when you walk the second or third comparable home, you might notice a persistent musty smell in the basement indicating water intrusion. You can't smell a photo.
Good point.
You might feel a slight unsettling dip in the floorboards under the rug. You might realize the 8-foot ceilings feel incredibly oppressive in person. Experiencing those flaws in comparable homes shatters the emotional spell of the first home. It grounds your decision-making in physical reality.
Okay. I am entirely sold on the physical walkthrough. I do not want to lose $20,000 because I got starry-eyed over a drone video.
Definitely not.
But a walkthrough only protects me if I'm analyzing the right data. Like if I'm trying to buy a 1950s mid-century modern home, touring three brand new modern farmhouse McMansions isn't going to give me an accurate anchor at all. How strict are the rules for picking these three homes?
They are incredibly strict because three rigidly matched reference points will always be 10 poorly matched ones. If you compare apples to oranges in real estate, the resulting data is worse than useless. It's actively misleading.
So let's outline the exact acceptable ranges for a valid comparable, straight from the source material. First up is the price band. The comparables must be within plus or minus 15% of your target price. That makes sense. $1 million estate is not a comp for a $500,000 home, even if they share the exact same street.
Correct. The materials and finishes at those different price points skew the valuation entirely. Next is location. The comparable must be in the exact same ZIP code, or if you are shopping in a heavily suburban area, the exact same school district.
Okay.
Property type is also a non-negotiable exact match. You only compare a single-family home to a single-family home, or a townhome to a townhome. If you're up in the high country, cabin to cabin.
We can't mix and match.
No, you cannot compare the maintenance structure and lifestyle of a condo to a detached single-family home. The valuation models lenders use for those are entirely different.
Moving down the list, living square footage needs to be within plus or minus 20%. Age band needs to be within 15 years of the build date. Though, there is a really fascinating local exception to the age rule mentioned here.
Oh, the historic districts.
Yes. If you are shopping in historically designated places like Buena Vista, the West End in Winston-Salem, or the older sections of downtown Greensboro, the 15-year age matching rule just goes out the window.
Because it has to.
Right. Because in those specific neighborhoods, the extreme age and the historical provenance is literally the point of the property. A 1920s craftsman and a 1940s colonial in a historic district hold similar prestige.
Right.
Whereas a 15-year gap in a modern subdivision represents entirely different eras of building codes and material quality.
It perfectly illustrates why understanding your highly specific local market is so critical.
Yeah.
What are the final criteria on the list?
Bedroom count should be an exact match, or at most plus or minus one. And finally, the lot type. You have to match interior lots to interior lots, corner to corner, flat to flat, wooded to wood.
That's a big one.
Yeah, a house sitting on a steep, unusable slope is simply not a valid comp for a house with a sprawling, flat backyard, even if the houses themselves are perfectly identical.
And once you've identified three comps that survive this gauntlet of criteria, the source provides some incredibly actionable advice on the timeline. You need to have your buyer's agent line up these three tours within a tight 2-week window.
Why the rush? I mean, why does it have to be within 2 weeks?
It's all about memory decay. If you view house number one on May 1st and house number two on June 15th, your brain is naturally going to blur the sensory details.
You just forget what it felt like.
Exactly. You won't be able to accurately contrast the amount of natural light in the living room or the tactile quality of the kitchen cabinets. To help combat this, the guide recommends taking just one photo of the kitchen, one of the primary bedroom, and one of the yard for your own reference. But crucially, you must actively avoid taking photos of the seller's personal items.
Because you are buying the structure, not their taste in interior design, the furniture is leaving on closing day.
Exactly. You do not want to accidentally anchor your valuation to their beautiful, imported, mid-century modern sofa. It is not part of the deal.
I get that. But let's say I'm following the rules. I walk into house number one, and it's just okay. I walk into house number two, it's not bad. Then I walk into house number three, and it hits me. It is absolutely perfect. It checks every box. It aligns perfectly with the comps. Do I need to go look at five more houses just to hit some arbitrary quota and prove to myself that I'm being thorough?
This is a really common anxiety for buyers. The guide actually pulls in 2026 data from iBuyers, which are those massive corporate cash buying entities that analyze millions of real estate data points to answer this.
What do they say?
Well, while their data shows that most successful buyers in the triad do end up touring somewhere between 8 to 15 homes in total, the 333 rule is designed as a floor, not a ceiling.
A floor, not a ceiling. I like how that frames it.
If the third home is the absolute winner and you've verified its value against the other two, do not force yourself to tour five more houses just for the sake of being thorough. In a competitive market, dragging your feet means you risk losing the home you actually want to a faster buyer. The absolute rule is simply, do not tour fewer than three.
Okay, so we have the buyer's 333 framework fully established. We've got the living reserve, the PITI reserve, and the three physical walkthroughs. But as I was looking through the source material, I realized we need to clarify the landscape a bit. Because the term 333 is somewhat informal, a buyer might Google it and encounter articles or financial advisors using similar names for totally different rules. The guide calls these the confusing cousins.
It's vital to separate these out so you aren't trying to apply a long-term investment formula to a pre-offer readiness check.
Right. First up is the 3303 rule, which is deeply adjacent but often confused. This was actually popularized by the blog Financial Samurai way back in 2009. It's a pure affordability screen, not a behavioral check.
The mechanics of that rule dictate that your housing costs should stay under 30% of your gross income, which prevents you from becoming house poor and unable to afford groceries.
Always a good idea.
Definitely. Second, you should have 30% of the home price saved in cash before buying. Why 30%? That covers a 20% down payment to avoid private mortgage insurance, plus a 10% cash buffer for closing costs and immediate repairs. Finally, the total home price should be a maximum of 3 times your gross annual income.
The source notes that truly sophisticated buyers don't choose between these frameworks. They run both. Then you have the holding period 333. This is a stability screen. The rule states you should plan to stay in the home for at least 3 years. You should realistically expect only about 3% annual appreciation. And you need to budget 3% for transaction costs when you eventually sell. Can you explain how those transaction costs eat your equity if you try to sell too fast?
Absolutely. When you sell a house, you pay agent commissions, closing costs, and staging fees. That easily hits 3% or more of the sale price. The guide points out that in the Triad Anchor Cities in 2026, home appreciation is only running between 1.4 and 3.4% annually.
Wow, that's pretty slow.
It is. So if you buy a house and try to flip it or move after just 18 months, the appreciation hasn't caught up to the transaction costs yet. You will physically lose money at the closing table.
Patience is mandatory in this market. And speaking of losing money, we have to talk about how our main buyer 333 rule interacts with the North Carolina due diligence period.
Oh, for anyone buying in North Carolina, this is arguably the most critical financial interaction in the entire process.
The due diligence period is essentially a post-offer inspection window. Mm-hmm. It's like paying to rent the market for a few weeks so nobody else can buy the house while you hire inspectors. The Market Pulse section of our source material drops a terrifying statistic. Median due diligence fees in NC are running around $7,700 right now.
It's wild.
That is non-refundable cash you hand over directly to the seller the minute your offer is accepted.
This perfectly illustrates why the 333 behavioral check must be completed before you make an offer.
Yes.
Imagine you skip the comparables, you fall in love with the Zillow listing, and you get under contract. A week later, your appraisal comes back, or you realize during inspections that you grossly overpaid. You are legally allowed to walk away from the deal. But you are leaving that $7,700 due diligence check on the seller's kitchen counter.
That is brutal.
Doing the physical walkthroughs up front is the ultimate insurance policy against surrendering that massive fee.
That is a harsh lesson to learn the hard way. So what does this all mean when we flip the script and look at the other side of the transaction? Because the guide also outlines a seller diagnostic 3333. Sellers are using their own framework to decipher what the market is trying to tell them.
Right. And it gives buyers a fascinating look behind the curtain. For sellers, this framework is entirely about diagnosing a stale listing based on 3 distinct escalating timelines: 3 days, 3 weeks, and 3 months.
Let's run a metaphor here to make sense of the seller's panic. Think of a new house listing like a gallon of milk placed on a grocery store shelf. At 3 days, it's the exposure test. It was just put on the shelf. If a home gets 0 showings in its first 3 days, the guide says it's not a price problem yet. It's a search level problem.
Interesting.
Yeah, the photos are too dark, the agent restricted access, or the price ban is filtering buyers out of the algorithm entirely. The milk is just hidden behind the orange juice.
But then you hit 3 weeks. This is the pricing verdict. If a house is getting plenty of foot traffic, buyers are physically walking through the door, but by day 21, there are 0 offers. The market has delivered a definitive verdict.
And the verdict is?
It is absolutely a price problem. Buyers are looking at your milk, comparing it to the milk next to it, and deciding yours is just too expensive.
The guide is incredibly specific here. They say a 21-day stall requires a decisive 3-5% price cut. On a $400,000 listing in Clemens, that's a $12,000 to $16,000 reduction. And they emphasize that one large, shocking cut is exponentially better than a series of timid $2,000 microcuts. A microcut just makes the seller look desperate and detached from reality.
And if the seller ignores that advice and waits until the three-month mark, they hit reputational damage.
Sticking with the metaphor, at 90 days, the buyers assume the milk is sour without even opening it.
Exactly. By 90 days, buyer psychology fundamentally shifts. They assume there is a hidden structural defect or a toxic mold issue. At that point, a price cut won't save it. You usually have to withdraw the listing entirely, take new photos, let it sit off market, and relaunch it later to scrub the digital stigma.
So as a buyer, understanding this diagnostic timeline gives me incredible leverage.
Oh, completely.
If I find a house that has been sitting for 22 days, I know the seller is feeling the intense psychological pressure of that three-week pricing verdict. They know a massive $15,000 price cut is looming. That means my slightly under-asking offer, backed by my solid knowledge of the three comps I physically walk, suddenly looks like a lifeline to them rather than an insult.
Knowledge truly is the ultimate leverage in real estate negotiation. Understanding their anxiety timeline allows you to dictate the terms.
Let's bring it all home and recap the absolute necessities for anyone listening who is gearing up to navigate this market. First, build your three-month living reserve to insulate yourself from the unexpected curveballs of life. Second, build your separate three-month PITI reserve to protect your mortgage and prove your financial strength to lenders. And most importantly, do not write a single check until you have physically walked three rigidly defined, carefully matched comparable homes. That is your impenetrable shield against overpaying by tens of thousands of dollars.
Reserve for life, reserve for the loan, and compare in person. It is a strict discipline that pays massive, tangible dividends at the closing table.
It really does. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. We've spent this entire deep dive unpacking how Teresa Overcash's guide vehemently insists that virtual tours and online photos absolutely do not count for your three comparables.
Right. They definitely don't right now.
But as we move deeper into the 2020s, technology is making massive leaps. We have spatial computing, we have Apple Vision Pro headsets, and AI-generated home staging is becoming virtually indistinguishable from reality, which makes me wonder, will technology ever get so immersive that it actually replaces the need for these physical tours?
It is the billion-dollar question for the real estate tech industry right now. Can they simulate reality well enough to capture our financial trust?
Right. But on the flip side, is our psychological tendency to anchor to a physical space just too deeply tied to our biology? Like, a VR headset can show me the layout perfectly, but it can't replicate the musty smell of a wet basement.
No, it can't.
It can't simulate the subconscious unease of a sloped floor beneath my feet, or the actual bodily feeling of how cramped a galley kitchen is when two people are standing in it. Are our physical senses always going to be the ultimate irreplaceable defense against a bad investment?
I suspect that until a headset can simulate the smell of hidden water damage, the physical walkthrough isn't going anywhere.
I think you're right. Something to think about the next time you find yourself endlessly swiping through Zillow at 2 a.m, falling in love with a house you've never actually stood inside. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. If you're heading into the real estate market soon, take a breath, run your own math, and make absolutely sure you lock in those physical tours before you make your next move. Catch you next time.